What is Zionism? What is its history? And what is its opposition, anti-Zionism? And what constitutes this history? The conversation has gotten so loud, yet it seems people don't really know the definitions of the terms themselves. It's time to cut through the rhetoric, noise, slogans, and soundbites and offer the debate an intelligible context. Join us to journey through the historical roots of this debate.
The State of Israel was born not after the Holocaust so that never again. The State of Israel was intended to be born by the Zionist leaders before so that never at all.
In each episode, we will explore how every type of Zionist thought was opposed by a certain brand of anti-Zionism. And we reflect on how these various debates persist to this day. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 4 of Zionism and Anti-Zionism, the history of two opposing ideas. Let's take stock of where we're at. Up until now, we've covered political, labor, and religious Zionism. Initially, religious Jews resisted Zionism because of its secular character, in opposition to Jewish theology about the Messianic Age. Although their image is frequently tokenized by anti-Israel messaging, today, only a small minority of religious Jews remain anti-Zionist. Christian anti-Zionism emerged from the centuries-old idea that Jews were dangerous to society and needed to be kept weak for their theology to make sense. Jews had to suffer for rejecting the Christian Messiah. These narratives eventually became secularized. We learned about the roots of the blood libel, based on the age-old narrative that Jews ritualistically slaughter Christian children and drink their blood. That this narrative persists in some way to this day, in the idea that IDF soldiers relish killing Palestinian children. On the other hand, there's been a shift in modern Christian theology, which has reimagined the Jews, transforming them from Christ killers into the ancient Hebrew Israelites, fulfilling biblical prophecy by returning to Zion. As we have seen, there are many forms of anti-Zionist Jewish thinking before the creation of the State of Israel. There was nothing inevitable about the success of Zionism. However, all other ideas failed, and Zionism remained as the only practical solution for Jewish survival. For assimilation, Bundism, communism, or socialism, and so on, the Holocaust was the final nail in the coffin. Zionism emerged from the intra-Jewish debate as the winning idea for the Jewish future, seen by the majority as the best solution to the Jewish question. From this point, most Jews were, and are still today, Zionist. In this episode, we focus on the creation of the modern state of Israel and on the origins of Arab and Islamic anti-Zionism. The position of the Jews in the Arab world has always been tenuous, but how did this relationship evolve as the new Jewish state emerged? Here's the historical breakdown.
In order to understand the sources of Arab anti-Zionism, we need to understand the status of Jews in Arab and Muslim lands. Without understanding how Jews were seen by Arabs and Muslims for the preceding 1400 years, we will not understand the sources of Arab anti-Zionism.
Before talking about Arab and Muslim perspectives on Zionism, let's go back to the start of Islamic civilization. In the early 7th century CE, the Islamic prophet Muhammad received a revelation from God, known as the Quran. Muhammad drew his initial following from the two holy cities of Mecca and Medina, which lie on the western coast of modern-day Saudi Arabia. After Muhammad's death, Islam as an empire expanded outside of the Arabian Peninsula, incorporating vast non-Arab populations. First came the Rashidun Caliphate, which expanded into North Africa and Persia, and also into Palestine, which was controlled by the Byzantine Empire at the time. After came the Umayyad and Abbasid empires,
which reigned until the middle of the 13th century in territories that stretched from Spain all the way to India. These initial empires were not only responsible for bringing Islam to the wider Middle East and beyond, but also Arab culture. It is important to understand, though, that the religion of Islam and Arab culture were quite intertwined. For example, Arabic was the language of the Quran, so all pious Muslims spoke and read the language. All pious Muslims also spent time in the heartland of the Arabian Peninsula as part of their religious pilgrimage to Mecca. Because of this, many areas of the Middle East that were touched by Islamic empires have become Arab in culture as well. For this reason, in the Middle East of the last two centuries, most of the inhabitants are both Muslim and Arab. The Middle East and Arab world were forever changed by the rise of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Turks, while originating in the area of modern-day Turkey, came to rule the Arab Middle East for almost half a millennium. From 1516 to 1917, the Ottoman Empire controlled Palestine. That means the Zionist movement and the first mass Jewish immigrations to Palestine occurred during the reign of the Ottomans. During the 19th century, European colonialism arrived in the Middle East. The French took control of Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, while the British grew their spheres of influence over Egypt, Yemen, and Iran. So, by the time World War I came and ended, the Ottoman Empire, who sided with the losing Central Powers, lost all of its territories to the European powers. Here begins the British mandate over Palestine. After World War I, the British and French were each given mandates over territories in the Middle East. The French over Greater Syria, and the British over Palestine, Transjordan, and Iraq. The British and French were supposed to help the local populations learn how to govern themselves, believing, as colonial powers often did, that they were not yet capable of self-rule. Yet in Palestine, the local populations, which included both Jewish Zionists and Arabs, increasingly demanded the withdrawal of the British. The Zionists based their demands on the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which became enshrined in the Constitution of the League of Nations. This declaration codified the British's favourable view on the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. The local Arab populations, however, believed that the British offered them conflicting promises and did not believe the Balfour Declaration to be legitimate in the first place. Violence between Arabs and Jews and the British would continue on and off from the 1920s all the way through Israeli independence in 1948. The worst outbreak of pre-state violence occurred between 1936 and 1939, known as the Arab Revolt. During these years, Arabs in Palestine demanded an end to the British mandate and a halt to Jewish immigration. The British responded with violent suppression and a plan, encapsulated in the British White Paper of 1939, to stop Jewish immigration to Palestine. Ultimately, slowing Jewish immigration was not enough to suppress the political aspirations of the Arabs or Zionists. Violent clashes and political campaigns did not cease. Because of that, the British decided to end their mandate in 1947, after World War II. The United Nations then took up the issue of Palestine, deciding to create two independent states, an Arab state and a Jewish state. This is known as the Partition Plan. The Zionists accepted, but the Arabs did not.
So a bit of background. Beginning with the 7th century, coming from Arabia, Islam and the Arab world conquer the entire Middle East and North Africa. Those are very successful conquests. And as a result, the entire region goes to Islam and adopts the Arab language, the Arab culture. And what we have from this point on is an Arab and Muslim Middle East and North Africa. Within those lands of the Arab world now and of Islam, there are still Jews. Again, many Jews converted to Islam, but there are remaining communities of Jews, some of them going all the way back to the Babylonian exile. Jewish communities in Iraq preceded the rise of Islam, preceded the Arab conquest. They go all the way back to the Babylonian exile. So you have Jewish communities across the Middle East and North Africa that are now living under Arab and Muslim lands. Now, those Jews are treated as a combination of, on the one hand, they are not forcefully converted, they're not pagans, they have a certain level of respect for being the people of the book, but having rejected and refused Islam and the final prophecy, they are treated as people of a lower status. There is never question that the Jews and Christians in Arab and Muslim lands are not the equals of Muslims and Arabs. That is very clear. During the centuries, it ebbs and flows, but there are certain markers that make it clear that Jews are not the equals of Arabs and Muslims. Sometimes they have to wear certain identifying elements. The yellow color comes from the Arab world, not from Europe. The condition of Jews in Arab and Muslim lands was never as good or as bad as it was in Europe. It never reached the heights of emancipation and equality, but it also never reached the lows of the Holocaust. With the coming of colonialism, the condition of Jews in Arab and Muslim lands begins to change. They are, in some places, given legal equality, upending the traditional status where it was clear that Arab and Muslims were at the top and Jews were of a lower status. With Zionism, this is really a challenge to this entire structure. What Zionism basically says is that the Jews view themselves on equal footing with Arabs and Muslims, not just as individuals, but as a nation, as a people, and where, if not in the land that is at this point in the middle of the lands that the Arab and Muslim world claims for itself. So we can begin to understand the challenge that Zionism presents to the Arab and Muslim vision of the Jews. By the time that we reach the middle of the 20th century, World War II, the Nazis have made substantial effort to recruit the Arab world to their side in an effort to get the Arab world to work and rebel against the British, their enemies at the war. And they insert into the Arab world European Nazi propaganda that views the Jews as particularly nefarious and with power behind the scenes. And those also begin to have an impact on the Arab and Muslim way of seeing Jews and seeing Zionists. During the time of the British Mandate in the interwar years, the Arab violence against the establishment of a Jewish state becomes stronger and stronger, ultimately peaking in the Great Arab Revolt between 36 and 39, after which Britain completely betrays the mandate and ends Jewish immigration at the most crucial hour to the Jewish people, and they have nowhere to escape to come out of Europe. And here we have to say something about Herzl's vision. We spoke about the fact that Herzl had a keen sense of urgency already at the end of the 19th century when everything looked good. And he already understood that Jews could not stay in Europe. His vision of establishing a Jewish state was intended to prevent what happened in Europe. One of the biggest mistakes that people make is thinking that Zionism or the State of Israel is a post-Holocaust phenomenon, a kind of notion that guilty Europeans after World War II gave the Jews some land that they happened to control so that the leftover Jews from the war can find a place of refuge. But it's exactly the opposite. The Jews themselves, through their own vision, through their own organization, by getting international legitimacy after World War I, established the state that was supposed to have its doors open to Jewish immigration from around the world. And whereas the British fulfilled their promise to the Arabs, not fully, but by establishing the states of Iraq and Jordan and Syria and Lebanon, the Jews are betrayed and they do not have their state at the most critical moment. The State of Israel was born not after the Holocaust so that never again. The State of Israel was born or was intended to be born by the Zionist leaders before so that never at all.
Let's briefly talk about the context and main figures associated with Israel's Declaration of Independence in 1948. After World War II, the British were out of money and were losing soldiers serving in Palestine left and right. In addition, World War II began a trend of decolonization in the Middle East. Lebanon in 1943 and Jordan and Syria in 1946, for example. Jewish refugees from Europe were seeking new homes and the Cold War was setting in. All of these factors led to the British giving up their mandate over Palestine to the United Nations. The UN organized a new committee, the UN Special Committee on Palestine. This committee met with Zionists and was largely boycotted by Arab politicians. It ultimately suggested the partition plan, Resolution 181, was approved by the UN General Assembly. This vote was one of the few times that the United States and Soviet Union both voted in favor of the same resolution, a product of their mutual interest in influencing the future independent Jewish state. When talking about the global effort to gain support for a Jewish state, one must mention Chaim Weizmann. Weizmann was an ardent Zionist for decades leading up to 1948. Meeting with Western leaders at every step to try and garner support for the movement. He was instrumental in acquiring the Balfour Declaration, as well as American support for the partition plan and recognition of Israeli independence. In fact, Weizmann wrote a personal letter to US President Harry Truman 1 month before Israel declared independence. In it, he wrote, "The choice for our people, Mr. President, is between statehood and extermination. History and providence have placed this issue in your hands."
After World War II, the Holocaust actually led many Zionist leaders to believe that the State of Israel would not be established because there's just no more Jews. And that the world will say, you don't need a state anymore because there's no more Jews who will need it. But ultimately, they're able to get support. The UN partition plan. It's half of the land that they were promised by the League of Nations. It does not include Judea, the cradle of Jewish civilization. It does not include Zion, Jerusalem, that forms the core of the word Zionism. And yet the Zionist leaders still say yes, because in their vision, what's important is for the Jews to have a state rather than every square inch that was mentioned in the Bible be part of that Jewish state. The Arabs reject partition. They do not reject it because partition was unfair or the maps were not drawn properly. They make it very clear at the time. They are rejecting partition because a Jewish state in any borders is unacceptable. In February of 1947, the British Foreign Minister Ernst Bevin, if you know about him, he was no friend to the Jewish people, not a supporter of Zionism, but he needs to explain to the people of Britain in Parliament why Britain is betraying the mandate, the trust, that it received from the League of Nations to help the Jews achieve sovereignty. And he explains that Britain is handing over the mandate to the United Nations, the heir of the League of Nations, because His Majesty's government has come to the conclusion that the conflict in the land is irreconcilable. Now, this is February 1947. There's no state of Israel yet. There's certainly no occupation. There's no settlements. There are no Arab refugees. All of the things that we are told are the source of the conflict don't exist yet, and still it is called irreconcilable. Why? Bevin goes on to say that there are two groups in the land, Jews and Arabs, so there's no question as to who the groups are. Those are two nations, two people, two collectives. It's not religion. As we discussed, it's very clear that it's about the Jewish people. And he says each one of those groups, the Jews and the Arabs, have a top priority. For the Jews, the top priority is a state. The Jews want a state. That's the goal of Zionism. The Jews want a state, that's Zionism. The Arabs want the Jews not to have a state, that's anti-Zionism, and it's irreconcilable. And Zionism and anti-Zionism go to war over their competing top priorities. The outcome of the war is that insofar as the goal of the Arabs in the land and after the British left, supported by several Arab armies, insofar as the goal was to prevent the establishment of a Jewish state, that has failed. Israel emerges from the war declaring its independence. There is now a Jewish state, again, not a religious idea, a secular Jewish state that can finally open its doors, open its borders to Jewish immigration. But from that moment to the present, the conflict continues to be between Zionism and anti-Zionism. That is the essence of the conflict. Everything that is discussed later become the details. And here we also understand the violent reaction. If from the Arab and Muslim perspective, the only way that they could understand Jews is as meek, powerless, stateless, not riding horses, not bearing arms, imagine the civilizational shock of having those Zionist Jews in the midst of the lands conquered to the Arab world and Islam, claiming their equality on par with the Arabs, riding horses, bearing arms, demanding that they defend themselves by themselves, refusing to give their defense over to the Arab and Muslim rulers. You could imagine the violent reaction. There's a phrase that goes around that says that to those accustomed to privilege, equality feels a whole lot like discrimination. If for 1400 years, the Arab and Muslim world is only ever used to thinking of the Jews as lower, the fact that Jews stand upright and demand to be looked at eye level as equals, there is something that feels wrong in this architecture if the only way that the Arab and Muslim world ever looked at Jews is down. To look at them as equals feels wrong. And as a result, there is a violent reaction intended to essentially put the Jews back where they belong, as those of lower class, of lower status, who understand their place. This is the source of the conflict. This is what you see in the charter of the Palestine Liberation Organization, established in 1964. If you look at maps of the PLO from that time, the Palestine they seek to liberate is not the West Bank that at this point is under Jordanian annexation or the Gaza Strip that is under Egyptian military rule. It is the area in between that is the independent state of Israel. That is the Palestine they seek to liberate. You look at the Hamas charter that has those same ideas under religious Islamic cover, but it's the same ideas. The idea is that a Jewish state in the land, in any borders whatsoever, is unacceptable. So this is now the essence of the conflict. We also see that this has impact broader to the entire region. The Arab world at this point organizes itself around the principle of anti-Zionism. Anti-Zionism becomes the defining political idea that binds the Arab world together. The Arab League, in many ways, is pulled together around anti-Zionism.
Before delving into the anti-Zionism that spread across the Arab world, we need to explore an explosive contemporary political movement, Pan-Arabism. Pan-Arabism, broadly speaking, is an ideology that sought to unite the Arab world. Similar to Zionism, Pan-Arabism was largely secular. Originating towards the end of the Ottoman rule and taking its initial form during the Mandate era, proponents of Pan-Arabism sought to rid Arabs in the Middle East of European control. After World War II, the Arab League was founded for this agenda. As we have seen, the Pan-Arabist goal of creating one Arab state across the region failed due to conflicting interests. However, the Arab world did coalesce over a shared disparagement of Israel, which became a political bargaining chip for Arab leaders. Perhaps the best known Pan-Arabist was the Egyptian president, Gamal Abdel Nasser. He was president of Egypt from 1954 to 1970. He called for Arab unity throughout the Middle East. Nasser succeeded in establishing the United Arab Republic in 1958, a Pan-Arabist union between Egypt and Syria. This ended in 1971. Nasser was the face of the Arab world in the era immediately after and in some places during decolonization. He was also the face of the Arab world at the onset of the modern Arab-Israeli conflict. Seeing Israel as an extension of the West's imperial ambitions, hostility towards the Jewish became another pillar of Pan-Arabism. On the military front, Nasser led the other Arab armies in battle against Israel in 1956 and 1967. On the diplomatic front, Nasser and other Arab states sought to isolate Israel by applying pressure on the United States and Soviet Union to not support the Jewish state. In many ways, the goal of avenging Palestine became a unifying principle in an Arab world that was anything but unified. One of the most significant and long-lasting legacies of the Arab world's hostility towards Israel is the expulsion of Jews from Arab countries. Collective punishment for the 1948 loss was exercised over the Jewish population in the Arab world.
Now remember, there are Jewish communities in the Arab and Muslim world that precede the rise of the Arab and Islamic conquests. And yet, as soon as the Arab world organizes itself around the principle of anti-Zionism, the environment turns hostile to Jewish life. As much as Arabs claim it's not about the Jews, as soon as they organize themselves around anti-Zionism, the environment turns hostile to Jewish life, and within a few short years, no Jews remain across the Arab world. In the 1950s and 60s, the state of Israel was able to open its gates to Jews who were ethnically cleansed from across the Arab world and give them a home. So by and large, the Jews were not murdered and massacred. There were some instances, but they were ethnically cleansed. In Europe in the 30s and 40s, if Israel had existed, if there had not been Arab violence and British betrayal, Jews could have escaped Europe to the state of Israel in the 1930s, as Herzl and the early Zionists intended. But because the gates were closed, because Israel was not given its independence in time, the condition of the Jews and the fate of the Jews was much different. Europe ultimately massacred them. The ethnic cleansing of Jews from Arab lands has no name. Few people know of it, and it's been kind of relegated to the forgetting of history. The Palestinian story of becoming refugees in war, not unusual situation in the 20th century, has come to be known as the Nakba, the catastrophe. Today it is presented as a story of innocent dispossession, of Palestinians losing their homes, having to escape as a result of the war. The Arab thinker who coined the term the Nakba, Constantine Zurayk, made it very clear that the Nakba, the catastrophe of the Arabs, was not about the dispossession. He describes it as seven Arab armies attempt to subdue Zionism and turn on their heels and go home impotent. The notion is that there is shame, there is humiliation, that the catastrophe is in having failed to defeat Zionism. The catastrophe is not the loss of homes as a result of war. The catastrophe is that the goal of the war, to defeat Zionism, to prevent the Jews from attaining self-determination and statehood in the land, in any borders, the failure to defeat the lowly Jews, the people who were always known as lowly, meek, powerless, the failure to defeat them, that was in real time known as the Nakba.
So to summarize, the debate between Zionism and anti-Zionism first started off within the Jewish community as Jews were figuring out the best idea for their future. However, over time, and especially after the Holocaust, the Jews decided on Zionism as the only solution, and it also remained the only practical solution for their survival. So the debate shifts from that and goes into all-out war when Zionism is met with Arab and Islamic anti-Zionism in the Middle East. And this characterizes the 1948 war and every conflict beyond that point. But it seems that every time the Arabs invaded or tried to wage a war against the existence of Israel, that it didn't work out. So why do you think that is?
I think fundamentally what the Arab and Islamic world did is misdiagnose Zionism. Rather than understand it as a movement of self-determination, as a liberation movement of a people that had a deep connection to this land, a connection that lasted for millennia, a connection that was very much at the core of their identity, of who they are, the fact that they only made sense as a sovereign people in that piece of land. They didn't accept the way Zionists viewed themselves, and rather diagnosed Zionism as a movement of outsiders, of foreigners, of therefore colonialists, people who are coming from the outside, today we would say white Europeans, but people who essentially came from the outside, like so many other powers. One of the major parallels that is often made in the Arab world with Israel is that Israel is the crusader state, the state that lasted for about a century. The notion is, again, we've seen this before. These are foreigners, they come here, and ultimately we're able to throw them out. So from their perspective, their misdiagnosis of Zionism is not a movement of self-determination of a people who have a deep connection to the land, who are essentially indigenous in that connection, but rather an invasion of foreigners. And because they have misdiagnosed Zionism and refused to accept the way that Zionists themselves describe their movement, they have failed in their response. Because if you think that this is a movement of invading foreigners, then the response is to push them out violently by any means necessary. But the Jews did not behave like foreign invaders or outsiders who, when met with violence, ultimately leave. they behaved precisely the way you would expect from a movement of self-determination and liberation of a people who have a deep connection to a land. They stood their ground because that was the essence of Zionism. And as the Arab world will finally begin to correctly understand Zionism as a movement of self-liberation of indigenous people, of people who have a deep and historical connection to the land, rather than as foreign invaders, they will then adjust their response and the conflict could be over.
There's no denying that 1948 was a traumatic shock and event for the Palestinians, and that that truth does also simultaneously exist beside the violent anti-Zionism that the Arab and Islamic world wages against Israel. And the 1948 conflict produced an equal number of Palestinian and Jewish refugees. So if you look at it in this context, it's not different, that different to any other historical conflicts.
So throughout the 20th century, empires recede, new states are established, borders are delineated. These borders don't always match the way that populations live. As a result, you have extensive movement, up to tens of millions of people across various borders in the 20th century. You have in the Indian subcontinent, between Hindus and Muslims, between India and Pakistan. You have it all across Europe. One of the most dramatic elements is actually of Germans who are ethnically cleansed from lands that become Poland and Czechoslovakia after World War II. And this is after the war is over. And you have it all around the world. You have Turks and Greeks and Bulgarians and Poles and Ukrainians. But throughout the 20th century, the message to these refugees is it's tragic. No one denies that the loss of home and war is tragic. But the message is move on. There's no going back. Once the empire is gone and the new states are established, the supreme principle is the sovereignty of the state. And every new state that is established can now determine who can immigrate to that state, who can become naturalized. Israel accepted many refugees, but they were Jewish refugees. That's what Israel wanted. Every state in the world accepted the kind of refugees that it wanted. What was unique about the Palestinians was not the personal tragedy. That's something that happened to many, many people during the 20th century in the process of creating new state. What was unique to them is because the principle of anti-Zionism was so supreme, because that was the top priority, there was a complete rejection of any notion that it's acceptable to declare the war over. If the refugees, which were Arab refugees, would be absorbed into the Arab lands, Jordan, Syria, Iraq, that if they would be absorbed, like all other refugees in the world were absorbed to other states, that would mean that the war against Zionism is over. And that was unacceptable. And as a result, the Arab world and within them, the Arab Palestinians, created a situation where they remained perpetual refugees as a way to say the war is not over. We may have lost the battle of 1948, but the war is not over. The war of Arab anti-Zionism against Zionism, against the establishment of a Jewish state in any borders, is not over and can only be over when Zionism is defeated.
And so it's fair to say that at the crux of the conflict, this is the issue, and that when people talk about the occupation or terrorism or settlements being the cause of the conflict, that's actually wrong.
Yes, one of the things that characterizes the conflict in general is reversal of cause and effect. We see it throughout in understanding the situation of Jews in Arab lands. So for example, there's this mythology that before Zionism, Jews in Arab lands enjoyed harmony and all was good, and it's only Zionism that destroyed it, rather than it being exactly the opposite. Jews were always of a lower status, and it is Arab anti-Zionism that ultimately compelled Jews to flee the Arab world. And reversal of cause and effect is one of the main elements in which the conflict is discussed. rather than understanding that it is Arab denial of the Jewish right to self-determination in any borders that is the cause of the conflict, that it is Arab anti-Zionism that is the reason that the conflict persists. And all the things that we hear about, the occupation, the Nakba, the refugees, the right of return, even the settlements, all of these are ultimately symptoms or things that are presented as obstacles but are not really obstacles, because at any moment when the Arabs had the opportunity to have their own state in the land, to achieve self-determination, but the price of that was that the Jews would also have self-determination in the other part of the land, because their top priority has been anti-Zionism, no Jewish state, at least to date, they have always chosen to say no to any Arab-Palestinian state that would legitimize next door a Jewish state.
I remember one of the most shocking parts of the course being reading the actual paper where the term the Nakba was coined by Constantine Zurek. How did this reformulation of the word happen in popular culture?
So amazingly, the kind of the commemoration of the Nakba, turning it into a main element of the identity rather than a kind of memory, having organizations demand around the right of return, really explodes in the 1990s when there were Palestinian leaders, Arafat, negotiating with Israeli leaders, Rabin and later Ehud Barak, over the possibility of partition, over the possibility of establishing a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. The Palestinian leaders have been at least willing to negotiate. But precisely as they were going to negotiate, it is the Palestinian people who were fearing that in negotiating, they will give up the principle of anti-Zionism. They will forgo return. They will agree to an Arab state next to a Jewish state rather than a single Arab state. So you begin to have all these grassroots Palestinian organizations speaking of the Nakba, speaking of return, in order to prevent their leaders from daring to negotiate with Israel, with Zionism, over partition.
We often hear in the West that, oh, Jews got Israel because of the Holocaust. But for the Jews, the sources of authority for Israel go way beyond the Holocaust. So how do we understand that from the Western perspective?
You're also right that it gets kind of messed and meshed with the idea that somehow Israel is a European creation, this guilty Europeans after the Holocaust give the leftover Jews some place in some areas that they happened to control. Sometimes I call this phenomena Zionism denial because it erases the agency of Jews. If we've learned anything about this course, is how prescient Zionism was already at the end of the 19th century to understand the risks, to understand the dangers, to develop the vision, the institutions, to build the state. And essentially, in all but independence, the state of Israel already existed in the 1930s. Sometimes I imagine what would have happened in the Evian Conference of 1938, where Hitler was still willing to let Jews leave Germany, but no country was willing to let the Jews in. Imagine if Israel could have gone and said, we want them. And again, we actually have a case study, because 20 years after that, in the 1950s, when 1 million Jews are ethnically cleansed from the entire Arab and Muslim world, now they have a place to go. In Europe, the final solution, the massacre of the Jews, began after it became clear that nobody wants them. So the only way for Europe to ethnically cleanse itself of Jews was to kill them. The Arab world, because there was Israel, Israel took in the Jews, and the Arab world remained without Jews throughout. So it completely erases to say that Israel is somehow a European gift. First of all, Europeans did not feel guilty after the Holocaust. It took them about a generation, if at all, to feel guilty. Some countries in Europe are still working on that. And they did not give the Jews their state. The Jews attained their state through their actions. And that's why it's so important to learn the history of Zionism, because it really shows you that it all happened long before.
So knowing what we know now, can you really be critiquing Israel if you're an anti-Zionist, meaning that you don't think the state should exist?
By definition, if you're an anti-Zionist, you're not criticizing the state of Israel. Criticism should have criticism ultimately intended at improvement. I was a member of parliament. We criticize Israel every day, all the time. That's what Israeli citizens do all the time. But they do it from the perspective of wanting the betterment of Israel, of wanting Israel to be better, of wanting Israel to be the best that it could be. To be an anti-Zionist is essentially to say that regardless of what Israel does, what we are concerned about is what Israel is. As long as Israel is the sovereign state of the Jewish people, we reject any legitimacy, and it should not exist. This is by definition not criticism. When someone bullies a kid and tell them, go kill yourself or you should die, that's not a criticism. And anti-Zionism is essentially a way to tell Jews in Israel, you should die, don't exist. Whatever you are is something that we don't want to be in the world.
Thank you so much. That was our pairing on the birth of the state of Israel versus Arab and Islamic anti-Zionism. Stick with us for episode 5 on secularism, contemporary left-wing anti-Zionism, and its roots in Soviet anti-Zionism. Thank you.